No mai, haere mai, piki mai, kake mai, hello and welcome to the 2020 Writers' Programme at the New Zealand Festival of the Arts. Shortly after 1 in the morning on April 26, 1986, the number 4 reactor at the Chernobyl nuclear plant in Ukraine, which was of course then part of the Soviet Union, exploded, spewing radiation across Europe. In Chernobyl, History of a Tragedy, Serhii Plokhii explores the lead up to the disaster. He chronicles the event itself in often painful, excruciating detail and its impact on both people and politics. Winner of the Bailey Gifford Prize for Nonfiction, which I think used to be the Samuel Johnson Prize.
Yes.
It's just a gripping read. It's a meticulous history that is remarkable not just for the quality of its scholarship but also for the quality of its storytelling. There's a great deal of detail here, but I think crucially throughout what Serhii does is he puts at the centre of it human beings. It's ultimately a story about human beings, and it's a great pleasure to have you here today, Serhii. Thanks for joining us. Serhii, in April 1986, you weren't quite a detached observer insofar as you were actually reasonably close to yourself physically to Chernobyl. Can you tell us a bit about that, and can you tell us how it came to your attention in the first place?
Yeah. Well, you started saying that the accident happened on April 26, and I have no recollections of April 26. I lived at that time 400 to 500 kilometers to the south from Chernobyl. What made that place maybe more dangerous than others was that it was on the bank of the Dnieper River, and the water, contaminated water, was coming downstream from Chernobyl all the way to the Black Sea. But we learned about people like myself, we learned about the accident not on the 26th, not on the 27th, not on the 28th, and eventually some information was announced on the April 29th. And most of what we heard was coming from Voice of America or BBC or Foreign Service BBC. So the government was really very tight when it comes to the information about the accident itself. And then, of course, the impact that it had on the territory, on the population, on people as a whole. So the news about Chernobyl, where we were getting them in stages, so to say, and that certainly created a major distrust of the government. As I describe in my book, that was also beginning in many ways of the fall of the Soviet Union. Again, it didn't exactly disintegrate because of Chernobyl, but Chernobyl was a major factor that undermined whatever trust the society still had in the government.
And I want to come back and talk about that a bit more in a moment. I want to skip ahead, though, to a trip you took to Ukraine, by this point living, I think, in the States, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, where you joined a trip as a tourist to Pripyat and the site of Chernobyl. And can you talk a bit about that and how that trip influenced you in terms of wanting to write this book and tell this story?
I was always interested in the story of Chernobyl, partially because that was part of my own story, a story of my classmates, a story of my students, because some of the students were actually drafted into the army around that time and sent to Chernobyl as bio-robots, so where the technology didn't work, people were sent there. And given what I just described, that we didn't really have much of information on what happened there, I was always interested in that. But for a while, it was maybe too close in terms of days and years that passed. So still, it was too painful. And also another thing was that we historians, I interviewed a number of people, but mostly we work with archives, mostly we work with documents, and those were not available. And I was thinking about when one day I should do that. And that trip to Chernobyl, where I was part of the group, there were eight of us all together, really convinced me that I had to do that. I was doubtful in a sense that, yes, it was Chernobyl was part of my life, but on the other hand, there were all these people who were there at that time, like my classmates or students, who had much more intimate and closer relationship. But what would I have to offer to the reader? And then on that trip, I realized that there was a young guide, very good tour guide. But she was born after Chernobyl, so certain realities that were there, she just couldn't understand that somehow it wasn't in the books. And I thought, okay, probably the right book wasn't written yet, so let me try to do that. So that's how it came. So I just realized that I'm ready to do that and that I have some background and some inside knowledge that maybe others don't have. At least the feeling of what how it was, how we felt about that, how really upset we were and that we were let down in terms of that information that was hidden from us. So there was that emotional thing that also was contributed to me starting to work on that book.
What were the people, other people on that tour there for? They had seemed quite a range of different motivations.
Yes. That was amazing. I never thought that people would go to Chernobyl for that particular kind of reasons. Again, there was a group of eight of us. There were four people from UK, and it seems to me three students from Hong Kong, and they were doing a tour of Russia and Eastern Europe. But the most amazing thing was with the British part of the group. So there were three young guys and young woman, and I said to them, what brings them there? And they said, well, don't you know the two fantastic computer games about Chernobyl, so we are playing them all the time. So, and then they decided, Amanda, who was the name of that young woman, asked her husband, Stuart, what he wanted to do for either his birthday or vacation. He said, let's go to Chernobyl. And then they brought us to this, sport complex where there was a water pool. Of course, there was no water there. And they said, they showed such a familiarity with the place. I didn't understand where it was coming from. Apparently, that pool was part of that computer game. So they knew every inch of that place. And again, it was quite a revelation for me. When I was working on the book, and that's how I started the book. Eventually, I emailed one of the guys, Stuart, and said, "Could you please give me the names of the game? I want to see what it was." And he gave that. And then when the book was out, and I was in UK doing book presentation and signing. Stuart emailed me and asked to sign the book, and he wasn't in London, he was somewhere else, so I left for him, it seems to me, in Waterstones, a book. So it was an interesting story. So there was the beginning, and then there was a continuation in terms of exchange of our emails. And today in Chernobyl, around Pripyat, we have tourist groups and organized travel, like I was a number of times part of that. But there is also illegal trespassing, stalkers, people who just go there for the thrill of being in this nuclear dangerous environment and camp there and try to avoid local police and so on and so forth. And they call themselves stalkers. But the stalker, the novel was there long before Chernobyl actually happened, which makes wow. It's really amazing how some people can really see things in the future, and that was one of those cases.
You talk in the book about the way that Chernobyl has come to take the form more of a myth, more and more over time, than in people's. So, is the kind of driving mission of the book to demythologize that idea? Is that part of it, to kind of just go through and document the reality of what happened?
Yes. Demythologization is an important part of what I was I'm doing there. Again, it is in the book, but I somehow never thought that through. That was my so I wasn't. It looks like I was on that mission without really fully realizing it. But for us, the story, let's say, of Chernobyl or Windscale fire in UK or Three Mile Island or Fukushima, the context in which those disasters happened are important for us not just for the sake of the storytelling or for the sake kind of archaeological dig to figure out what it was there. But also to understand and to learn, right? And you can't, in order to prevent such events in the future, and you can't learn much in that sense from mythology, right? So you have to go deeper, you have to reconstruct the environment, the story, the political, the cultural, the understanding of. There is a lot about culture, at least I wanted to write about culture, including safety culture or the lack of safety culture. And this is also very, very particular for a place. It's very particular for time. It's very particular for an era in which that happened, which was also Cold War, right? I have that episode and eventually probably we'll talk about that as well, but Mikhail Gorbachev, a major larger-than-life figure in the history, of course, of the end of the Cold War. So he goes and speaks to the nation about Chernobyl, and you look at that. What? 3 weeks after that happened, he goes and starts talking about that. For more than 2 years, he never visited the place, which is unbelievable, but that was part of the Soviet culture. Mm-hmm. He behaved the way how he was trained. He learned how the leader behaves. And then I mentioned Cold War when he was talking about Chernobyl. Two-thirds of his speech, it's May 1986, are about attacks on the West, right? So in mere 5 years, 3-4 years, the Cold War would be over. The Soviet Union would be gone. But in May of 1986, that's how Gorbachev behaves, which tells you a lot of how society changed dramatically, and Chernobyl was very much part of that.
There's a line, I think by his former translator, about that speech. I think it's specifically about that speech, which is something like, that speech opened up a rift between the people and the government that never quite closed. Is that your reading of it? Did that speech go down badly or come to go down badly with the people of the Soviet Union?
Absolutely, I remember that very well. And on the one hand, there was again the Soviet Union is a country that went through Stalinism and Great Terror and other things. So from that point of view, there was never much of trust between people and the government to start with. But then something happens. After long period of this Kremlin deaths, three leaders died in 3 years. Then Gorbachev, young and articulate, comes to the scene, and there was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of belief that actually he'll change the society. So there was that element of trust. And then Chernobyl happens. And he goes there and, first of all, conceals information and then does this things, really turns that into a weapon, an ideological weapon in the Cold War. And I remember a colleague of mine in Kyiv was saying, okay, no, he is finished. No one will trust him anymore. And when I was working on that book, I went and worked in the former KGB archives in Kyiv. Now they're open. And I found more or less the same kind of formulations that were there, that the people who were monitored by the KGB were thinking along the same lines. So what I heard, and I still remember, in May of 1986 in Kyiv, now it's also recorded in the KGB archives, which means that it wasn't just a sentiment of one individual person. There was a much broader more spread kind of a sentiment that was in the society. Again, very interesting. On the one hand, it all started with very little trust between government and the people, but then Gorbachev brings this trust
when he comes to power.
When he comes to power, yeah. and then Chernobyl. So that was also the reason why I put that quote from Gorbachev's interpreter into the book, because one thing is when you are the author, you really have a lot of freedom. You can put one quote into the book and not put another one. So you pick and choose. So I like that one because again, in my own experience, in the archival work that I did, that sounded for me true.
In terms of the way that the disaster played out, and we'll come to talk about it a bit more in detail in a moment, but outside the Soviet Union, it first came to the attention of the world, oddly enough, in Sweden, of all places. Can you talk about that? It's quite an interesting scene that you paint in a power plant in Sweden.
Yeah. The story is that it was on August, on April 29th, that they picked up the high level of radiation levels rising at the nuclear power plant near Uppsala in Sweden. And their first concern was, okay, something was wrong with the nuclear power plant. So they checked everything, they shut down the operations, everything was clean. They checked other nuclear power plants in Sweden. Again, everything was fine. And then they started to pay attention to the direction of the wind. And the wind was coming from the other side of the Baltic, and they realized that something terribly wrong happened in the Soviet Union. So the Minister of the Foreign Affairs of Sweden, the other agencies try to get in touch with their Soviet counterparts, and the Soviet counterparts say, no, everything is fine, everything okay, nothing happened. And only later that day, there is a first very terse kind of announcement on TV that an accident happened at Chernobyl, but without any details. So really, really, it was the attempt to conceal information from the very beginning. And they did that before. They did that before a major, major nuclear accident happened at the facility that produced plutonium for nuclear bombs, and the facility was in the Ural Mountains. And because that was so deep in the Soviet Union, they were able actually to hide that accident. But Chernobyl was in European part of the Soviet Union, pretty close to the borders. The direction of the wind was going toward Northern Europe. So they didn't get away with Chernobyl, but back in 1957 there was a secret nuclear accident, which is now among the six largest nuclear accidents in the world. Maybe five if you don't count the Castel Bravo and Atoll Bikini. Five or six largest accidents, and one of them was hidden and people didn't know about it until 1980s.
And there was another one in 1975, I think, as well. Did people know about those? Was that something that people knew about in Ukraine?
Right. Well, the one that you mentioned in 1975 was a relatively minor accident at the nuclear power plant near St. Petersburg. And unfortunately, accidents happen all the time. And all over the world, relatively limited release of radiation. And that was one of those. But what was important about that accident near St. Petersburg in 1975 was that one of the underlying reasons why it happened were exactly the kind of the reasons for which Chernobyl happened. But it was the situation of the Cold War. It was paranoia. It was obsession with secrecy. So the culture of secrecy trumped the culture of safety. And that information really was not shared even with the people within the industry itself. St. Petersburg nuclear power plant was also run by the really militarized arm of the Soviet government, so that contributed to the secrecy as well. So at the end of the day, the atmosphere of secrecy was also one of the contributing factors to Chernobyl.
Let's talk a bit then about what happened, and you said has in common with 1975. On that night of April the 25th, I suppose it was, there was a test that was going to be a turbine test. And can you give us a kind of, for people who aren't super familiar with it, just a kind of Coles notes on what then happened and the kind of...
Right, sure, absolutely. Well, the sad irony of the situation was that the test that you just mentioned and that they were doing was supposed to improve the safety of the reactor. It turned out that when they were shutting down the reactor, in general, again, there were dozens of reactors like the one that worked in Chernobyl. Reactor is shut down, but it's still very hot, and you need water to be continually supplied to it, even after it's not in the working condition anymore. And electricity that was going to the pumps that were bringing that water was also generated by the same reactor. And when they were shutting it down, the emergency generators were kicking in, but there was a gap of a second or a couple of seconds, and they thought that was actually a dangerous situation. So they were trying to find out once you shut down the reactor, the turbine still keeps rolling, and they wanted to find out how long it can roll, and maybe it can actually still produce electricity to deal with that gap. And That was the nature of the test, but the problem was that to run that test, they shut down a number of emergency systems for the water supply and for other things, thinking that nothing can happen. One of the operators said, well, the probability of anything happening within that short period of time when we shut all the systems off was like an airplane falling on you.
Mm.
What they didn't know was that the reactor that they were running actually had a major, major problems. There were a number of those, but one of them was that the control rods that made out of boron that go into the active zone of the reaction and shut down the reaction there. At their tips, there were pieces of graphite. And those pieces of graphite, when they get in, what they do not the low the intensity of the reaction, but there is a spike in the reaction. And if the reactor is stable, it doesn't mean much. But that reactor wasn't stable. And there were a number of other issues with the technology of the reactor. One of them was that it was the so-called graphite reactor. Most of the reactors in the world are water reactors, so water doesn't burn. Graphite burns. The British first learned that in October of 1957, the so-called Windscale fire, when graphite caught fire in one of the first British reactors. And after that, they shut down those reactors. They adopted new technology, but that technology continued going in the Soviet Union. So that was another major problem. So what happened, they were trying to do that test. They were shutting down the reactor, and the reactor became unstable. Eventually, they lost control over it. The biological shield that was on the top of the reactor, the weight of it, it's 200 tons, it's mostly of concrete, was blown into the air. it got back on the reactors. So imagine your kettle or something like that, where the cover goes up. It ended up there, but it didn't close it completely. There was a gap there, and the graphite caught fire. And with that fire and with smoke was spreading the radiation, and it was spreading all over the Europe. Again, Sweden was part of that, UK was part of that. Today we have a map of the fallout. And interesting thing about the fallout is that within the that exclusion zone, the 30 kilometer zone, there are some very extremely dirty, as they say, so very contaminated parts and areas. That's where tourists normally don't go. But then there are also clean areas, because it all depended on the precipitation, of how the wind was going, how the rain was going. But there are quite dirty places in the Alps, for example. Mm. Austria, theoretically, is after Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia, Austria is probably the most affected country. The Alps, and there are these dirty spots all over the Europe in general, which raises a big question about nuclear industry as a whole, in a sense that the decisions are made on the national level. So there is a sovereign right of a nation to have a nuclear power facilities, and profit from that, or the benefit from using that power, also goes into nations' coffers. But when something happens, that immediately becomes an international issue. It's the world as a whole that picks up the bill for what happened. And again, Chernobyl is the primary example of that fact, that our ideas and understanding of sovereignty, which come really from the 16th and 17th century, are facing challenges that two or three generations before were completely unimaginable.
I mean, there's quite a lot of discussion about nuclear arms and demilitarization and so on, but relatively little about nuclear power now, and indeed a lot of people who were very skeptical about nuclear power, environmentalists, some prominent ones, have changed their view about nuclear power because it seems a better option than more environmentally damaging ones. Do you think we need to be talking more about those points that you just raised, the risks?
Yes, the nuclear power is a very risky way of getting energy, and it's also not as cheap as certainly it was promised in the 1950s. The promise was that the electricity would be too cheap to meter it, so it's expensive to build it, so the investment at the beginning is quite substantial. But then there is also the problem what to do with nuclear waste. And that problem is not resolved yet. So there are major problems anywhere you go, political problems and otherwise. The attitude of people is, yeah, this is a great idea, but not in my backyard. You really invest in taking care of that nuclear waste years and decades after the nuclear power plant is already being shut down. This is in the circumstances when everything else goes well. You still need huge investment at the beginning. Mm-hmm. You need huge investment at the end of decommissioning that and decontamination, and then for foreseeable future you still have to keep the eye on the nuclear waste. And again, Chernobyl is very interesting in the sense that the state that built the reactor, that got again benefit in terms of nuclear energy, in terms of electricity from it, doesn't exist anymore. right? So it's a very interesting thing. The reactor, the nuclear problem, the state that built it is gone already. The responsibility of that state is not there anymore. There are three most affected states that were formed on the ruins of the Soviet Union. So the most affected one is Belarus, then Ukraine and Russia. But for different reasons, none of these countries, particularly Ukraine and Belarus, are capable financially and otherwise to deal with the problem that was created by Chernobyl. So last summer, they completed the construction of the new shelter. Mm. It's a multi-billion project, paid, again, Ukraine contributed, Russia contributed, Kazakhstan and others, but mostly paid by the money coming from G7. And if everything goes well, that new multi-billion structure will be good for 100 years. Right? So for 100 years, whatever the state is there, there has to be some authority, people, money, and others that would actually take care of that structure. And once it's gone, it doesn't mean that the problem is gone. The half-life of some of the isotopes released by Chernobyl, again, not in huge numbers, but the half-life is 24,000 years. Right? So that's also another thing to consider when we try to understand of whether the electricity produced by nuclear is cheap or expensive. And in some cases, it is extremely expensive. If you look at the figure in dollars or yenas or whatever, in terms of the lawsuits that were filed in Japan after the Fukushima, it actually goes in billions, which says that the contemporary law-based society like we have in Japan is really not equipped, or at least legal system is not equipped to deal with the disasters like Fukushima. So another big question. So the argument that I'm making is not let's ban nuclear. Mm. But I'm trying to make a different argument. The argument that I want to make is that we shouldn't invest into the nuclear as the really energy of the future. But we should invest today in the safety of nuclear reactors that are already there. And it's the most probably troubling thing is that the new frontier for nuclear is not anymore the countries that already have some experience in dealing with accidents or with nuclear energy. It's not U.S., it's not even Russia, it's not U.K. It's now Middle East, extremely volatile region. Nuclear, another important thing about nuclear, that's why the nuclear reactor in Iran gets so much attention, is that it's also a backdoor to acquiring nuclear weapons. So you really, the political leaders in the world try to talk about these things as not related, that you can have one and not have another. And allegedly the idea was that if you have nuclear energy, then there will be no urge to get nuclear weapons. That was President Eisenhower's idea, Atoms for Peace. But in real life, it doesn't work that way. So that's another additional risk associated with nuclear.
I mean, you mentioned the countries that now have nuclear energy facilities. And there's also, you touch on it in the book a bit, the danger of foul play, terrorism even. And we saw that in Iran with the Stuxnet virus, which shows that, I mean, that was assumed to be an American operation to disable, but it's frightening to think what the potential is with something like this in a kind of digital dystopian way, mm-hmm. Right?
Yes. And this is certainly all very true. It's on a certain level, it's like imagining nuclear bomb sitting right there, which certainly terrorists can activate, or the governments, right? And the governments were the biggest terrorists in the 20th century. So that's the reality when you look at the wars, at conflicts, and so on and so forth. And now there is a new weapon that the governments in particular have, cyber warfare. And with cyber warfare, it's very easy to just cut off electricity from any place on the territory of a possible enemy. And cutting electricity off from the nuclear power plant, that means that actually the nuclear power plant explodes. Because this is the story of Fukushima. Why it happened in Fukushima? Because the supply of electricity to that area was stopped because of the earthquake and then tsunami. So what that meant was that the pumps were not working, were not bringing water there. And despite the fact that the reactors were shut down, they were actually they still needed a long cooling period. So you cut off electricity from a place like that and you get Fukushima. And in today's world, there are already certainly a couple of attempts that show that they can cut off electricity just by pressing the computer button somewhere in the other part of the world. That's another danger that wasn't with us probably 5 or 10 years now it is here. You don't have to drive a truck to get to the nuclear power plant to create problems.
One of the thesis, I suppose, or one of the themes you explore is the extent to which Chernobyl and the events around it, we talked about Gorbachev, influenced the end of the Soviet Union, Ukraine becoming an independent state. I wanted to try sort of put a counterfactual. There are lots of ways that are also explored in the book that Chernobyl didn't happen. I mean, it required a bunch of different things to to go wrong across the board for it to happen. Let's say, if it hadn't happened, do you think it would have changed the course of history? I mean, I'm not suggesting that the Soviet Union would still be going or anything like that necessarily, but did it have a kind of material impact in a way that it would have changed those final years, do you think?
Well, It's an interesting question, and I was thinking about that, making this argument, but also understanding of limits of that argument. And at the end, I came up with a formula that, yes, the Soviet Union certainly would fall apart one way or another. Speaking about the Soviet Union, we forgot that was basically the old Russian Empire. And 20th century is the century that very few empires, actually real empires, survived. Right? That's the age of decolonization and the age of sovereignty for the states that come out of the empire and imperial history. And again, from that point of view, New Zealand has of course a lot of its own history. Again, there were general rules and economic inefficiency and so on and so forth. But I would say that it would be quite conceivable that the Soviet Union would continue for some time more, that the disintegration would take place in a different way if Chernobyl would not happen. The way how the Soviet Union fall apart, it's difficult to explain fully without taking Chernobyl into account. Because Chernobyl became really the trigger for change of the government policy when it comes to managing media and freedom of speech in general. Chernobyl created a situation in which the government was actually forced to start speak at least half truthfully to the people out there. Outrage was huge. And Chernobyl, and this is interesting about radiation, that it affects you whether you are a member of the Communist Party or not, whether you are an academician or your whatever job you're doing, whether you have right connections or not, whether you're a member of Politburo. So suddenly the ideological, social and other differences and borders that existed within the society disappeared because of Chernobyl, right? So that was a big unifying thing in terms of the society. And the issues related to nuclear and environment became the first legal issue that the government actually allowed its citizens to organize around. So the mass politics in the Soviet Union started with Chernobyl and started with nuclear. And for those of you who maybe watched the HBO series on Chernobyl, the most of the shooting was done at the nuclear power plant, which was basically a twin nuclear power plant to Chernobyl. It was located in Lithuania, in Ignalina. And that's where they were doing that shooting. So the mobilization in Lithuania, the first mass mobilization happened around the Ignalina nuclear power plant after Chernobyl. Out of that was born the movement for independence of Lithuania. Mm. Why it is important? Because Lithuania was the first republic that declared its independence from the Soviet Union in March of 1990, so more than 1 year before the fall of the Soviet Union. And the mobilization, political mobilization, happened around Chernobyl in Ukraine as well. Why it is important? Because Ukraine was the, once Ukraine declared its independence in December 1st, 1991, the Soviet Union was dissolved within the next week. So the first and the last republics that declared independence. In both cases, the political mobilization started around nuclear and started around Chernobyl. You just can't not to include that into the history of the fall of the Soviet Union and not to think about that. But you're absolutely right. Again, without Chernobyl, the writing for the empires has been on the wall through the most of the 20th century.
You mentioned the HBO series, which a lot of people will be familiar with. It was critically acclaimed, I think it's fair to say. What was it like for you, one of the someone who'd literally written the book on Chernobyl, to watch that? I mean, how did they do? What's your kind of?
They did very well. They really tried to be as precise as they could with every small detail. So the recreation of the Soviet, of the late Soviet reality, was really quite amazing. But that is not a documentary. So they cut a lot of corners, and they missed a number of cultural things that were there. They had to create heroes and villains. Mm. One of the probably most disgusting characters in the miniseries is the director of the nuclear power plant, Mr. Bryukhanov. The guy who, for those of you who maybe watched, there was an older party leader who gave that speech that we have to protect our people from information as opposed to radiation. And then the miniseries was still there, and I went to Ukraine, and I was given a couple of talks and was together with some of the former operators from the nuclear power plant. And I thought, oh my gosh, how they will actually react to that. Mm. But the reaction was extremely, extremely positive. They knew that the creators of the film did certain things wrong, but they were so pleased that the world actually remembers about them, remembers about their lives, about the health that they lost, and so on and so forth. So overall, the reaction was positive. And in the miniseries, there is an episode where there are three people who dive into the water and fix a valve that was out there. So The miniseries were released in May and first half of June, if I am not mistaken. Before the end of the June, the president of Ukraine awarded those, two of them were still alive, it seems to me, with the Hero of Ukraine medal. So again, the reaction was positive in the place where I thought that there would be a lot of criticism, but it didn't happen that way. And overall, my assessment of the miniseries, that they got a lot of small truths wrong, but they got the big truth right.
Thank you. Let's people, I'm sure, have questions. We have microphones in the middle aisle here, I think. And I will just say, on that point, those of you who have seen the TV series and not read the book, you recognize many of the characters in the book, and I think, to Sahih's credit, they are the ones that are kind of villains have a mixture of heroism and villainy, and the other way around. And
so they're more or less real
people,
right?
It's kind of interesting to see that. Who's going to come and grab? Here's a gentleman here who's on his way.
What happened to the frequency of radiation-induced cancer, such as thyroid cancer, following Chernobyl in places like the Ukraine?
There is a lot of debate and disagreement on what is the impact of Chernobyl on health, or for that matter, any nuclear disaster. And the reason for that is that we as a society don't know enough about the impact of the low dosages of radiation on human beings, on environment in general. And we don't know that because the plans after Chernobyl to have a major study of those impacts, like the one that was commissioned after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, actually never happened. And when you would Google the number of additional deaths that came out of Chernobyl, you can get estimates anywhere from 4,000 to 90,000. Greenpeace, it seems to me, gives 90 or more than 90,000. And the UN agencies somewhere around 4,000 to 5,000. So this is quite a difference, which means actually we really don't know what we are talking about. There is one exception, and this is thyroid cancer among children. That's where everyone agrees. That's what, and the number of thyroid cancer, the spike, additional thyroid cancer, because they occur naturally as well, is around 4,000. The good thing is that among other cancers, it's relatively easy identifiable, and you can actually operate on people. So that doesn't mean death sentence. But that's the kind of data in terms of the impact on the health, the thyroid among children that we have some clarity. Other than that, we still don't know.
My understanding of Chernobyl today is a place where the wildlife and everything is flourishing, that there's been something there that's really beautiful that's happened.
What is happening with the wildlife? It's not only back, but some of the animals that were never there before actually got into the zone. Some of them, I understand, a particular type of bear migrated all the way from Central Europe. I never knew that there were just forests that you can actually do that, and that you can cross the borders of European Union without proper visa and all sorts of precautions. But apparently this is happening. And the argument that is being made is, okay, there is nothing so terribly bad about radiation. The life is flourishing, wildlife. It's a very sobering thing for us to think that, okay, the radiation is there, but the animals are there because we are not there anymore. That we as human beings, we are actually create a much bigger danger than radiation. The argument about how healthy the life is there is again, that's one of the things that is being debated. The people who are doing research there walk into the forest and realize something is wrong. They don't understand what is wrong. Then they realize, okay, there is no spider web there. So there are no spiders. And there are no spiders because they somehow are related on the surface of the ground there, and that surface is irradiated. Mm-hmm. And there are no cherry trees because there are no birds that allow those trees to grow. And the birds are not there because there is something else is absent, and so on and so forth. Life is there of a very particular nature, that some species are there, other species are not there. And then it also depends on the particular area in the zone. So again, I would be very cautious to say that the wildlife in particular is just flourishing there, despite the fact that there are some reasons to think that.
We're just about out of time. I want to squeeze in this very last question, sure. A quick question and a short answer, and then we won't be breaking curfew too badly.
Is there a positive side to radiation in the transformation of us as human beings?
I want to think that there is something positive that can come out of that, but it depends on us, right? What we make out of what happened. Do we learn those lessons or not? And again, I want to think that